welcome everyone to Rock M Nation podcast. We are back. It is a brand new episode. It is a brand new year. It is the 3rd of January and the year 2022. It's hard to believe as I say that. Dive Cuts, we are season 5, episode 14. I am your host, Sam Snelling. With me forever, never able to get away, despite all his attempts to, Matthew J. Harris. Matt, how are you?
I'm well. I can say I can say definitively, this podcast has not gone on COVID pause.
It's not. I actually saw
as much
your
as our
tweet.
Audience would probably like us to be.
Yeah, I saw your tweet about like screen capping somebody that was like, you know, the Mario and you know, people that have not caught COVID in December 2021, like running through the Mario phase with all the big long fireball things.
Yeah.
So I always like to add the caveat that I have yet to catch COVID that I know of. You know, it is entirely possible, like pre-vaccination and all that kind of stuff, at some point I may have picked it up and just not shown symptoms. It's always possible. But to my knowledge, I have not caught COVID, and sounds like you're in the same boat.
We are not in the Missouri basketball program though, and that seems like the obvious place to start given the news that came down this afternoon.
Yeah. So Missouri had to punt on its game, first home game of the SEC conference season against Mississippi State, coming off back-to-back losses to Illinois and Kentucky that were routes, both of them. I think getting a home game against a team who's, you know, decent but not elite, maybe would have helped Missouri, I don't know, to like figure something out. I think judging by some of Konzo Martin's like past issues playing against Ben Allen, maybe it's for the best. But the game has been postponed. It has not been canceled. For anybody, you know, who follows the women's side, terrific win, by the way, the ladies, as they took down number one South Carolina. They had to kind of do the same thing and postpone their game against Vanderbilt. That has already been rescheduled. So they are actually going to play that game. I think they were going to make every effort for Missouri and Mississippi State to make up that contest. And we're hoping that they're able to play on Saturday.
Yeah. Right now, the game Wednesday is off the books. Konzo Martin, I think on his radio show, said tonight that they're hopeful that they're going to get enough guys out of COVID protocol by Thursday that they'll be able to clear, I think, what is it, the 8-man kind of cutoff to go to have Bama on Saturday. So that, I think that's sort of the optimistic take right now. The upside of this, if there is any, is that the SEC, in accordance with the changing CDC protocols, has cut that pause window down from 10 to 5 days. So if you've got guys who, you know, tested positive last Friday or Saturday, they're going to come out of that pretty quickly, you know, by late week. So that's the upside here, is that the conference adapted its protocol to what's happening on the ground. It stinks to lose a game, but it's better than what it would have been a year ago, where we probably would have lost a Wednesday game, a Saturday game, and maybe would have imperiled something early next week. Ideally, you're going to have enough guys to play on Saturday and then roll into the rest of the SEC schedule and just wait for a makeup date for this Mississippi State game. So that's best case scenario at this point. And you know, maybe having 10 days off will help Missouri find itself or find something that can give it a chance here. But
Illinois is on pause too, right? So yeah. Missouri played Illinois. Both teams were at full strength. Then Konzo Martin tested positive. Illinois has since, and not saying that it's tied to that Illinois game. I think the incubation period might have been a little bit later than that. It was probably around the holidays. But I, you know, my first thought as soon as like you know, Martin tested positive before the Kentucky game, I was like, well, there's no way that he's going to be the only one.
No, I mean, it was just a matter of when those guys popped. We're at the, you know, if you're not, nothing. This, and I don't want to in any way sound like I'm saying, oh, it was a foregone conclusion they were going to get it. They were just caught in probably a weird situation where if you were looking at, you know, vaccination timelines, they may have been at the end of waning immunity. They went home. You know, this thing is so prevalent now, and you know, the R factor on its spread rate is so high that if you get it, and the incubation period for viral load is so low that it's much lower than the, you know, OG COVID or even Delta, that you're going to get it pretty quickly here. And, you know, unfortunately, that's what's happened here. Now, it sounds like a lot of the guys were asymptomatic. At least that's what Missouri's reporters have tweeted out, you know, listening to Konzo's show tonight. So if they're asymptomatic, they haven't experienced any issues, and Missouri's lining up boosters right now, the best you hope for was this was just a case of unfortunate timing. And you're going to only lose one game. You're going to be able to make it up. I'm looking at the schedule now. There's not really any great time here. You know, there's not like a period where they're off for a midweek. You know, it's all racked and stacked. The question is where they decide to drop it and make it up at this point. You know, what makes most sense to do that? But we'll see. I would rather them just, you know, do it a couple weeks from now when Missouri's already in the state of Mississippi at Ole Miss. Maybe see if you can try and, you know, wedge it in somewhere there. But there is no real ideal time right now. It's probably going to be a 3 games in 10 day type of situation.
Yeah.
Just looking at the schedule right now.
Did they play the Bulldogs twice?
Yeah, they have a February 19 road trip.
So realistically, if they did the road trip to Ole Miss, they could flip like the home game and the road game, provided the facilities
all good to go.
Yeah, so that's kind of what you were going for. That's not a bad idea. It's one of those games where it probably isn't going to play that big a role. I'm sure like the Bulldogs would, you know, like to get a road win. That would sort of help their fairly flimsy resume, if they're hoping to sort of make the NCAA tournament. But, you know, it's also one of those games where, you know, Missouri has now beaten a couple teams that are like similar to Mississippi State, and you'd hate to that's certainly one of those games that like spoils a resume. It's sort of like losing to Vanderbilt a couple years ago. You can't lose that game. And if you do, like you have no reason to expect that you're an NCAA tournament team.
Yeah. It's a quad 3 loss right now, if you take it to Missouri for most schools at least this point. So, I would rather, like I said, if you flip the dates where Missouri, played at Mississippi State in a couple of weeks, it would likely suck because you'd have 3 straight road games at Ole Miss / Mississippi State, then Alabama. But conversely, if you were to make that February date a home game, you'd be home against Ole Miss, home against Arkansas, home against Mississippi State, home against Tennessee. So it would come back to you later on. So that's why I would almost want to try and see if you could flip it that way. Because on balance, Missouri comes out okay. And I think it's still, and Mississippi State still comes out okay. But we'll see what the SEC does and what the office and the schools come up with.
And we'll also see, like, you know, how many more games are postponed. They may have to make decisions on, you know, what games they want to make up and, you know, what are going to impact league standings, you know, more, you know, like if Mississippi State, like, you know, for some reason has to miss a game, you know, versus, you know, Alabama or Tennessee, they're a lot more likely to want to make that game up, you know, than they will against somebody like Missouri. It's sort of like when Texas A&M went on pause. Yeah. Last year, they're just like, no, we don't need to make any of those games up. Like, Texas A&M wasn't beating anybody.
No, and you already see those conversations happening out in the West Coast Conference.
Yeah, true.
They're already meeting to decide how they can keep, you know, BYU, US, San Francisco, St. Mary's and Gonzaga all kind of playing their round robin games, because, you know, this is a a banner year for that league, and they want to do as much as they can if they're going to lose games to keep those team schedules robust enough that they could all be in contention for at large bid. So this season's not there yet, but the A-10 and the WCC appear to be having a lot of issues right now with postponements and stuff. So it'll be interesting to see what gets prioritized and what doesn't as we move ahead. But for now, the game is off Wednesday, but it seems like there's enough wiggle room here in Missouri. If Martin's accurate in his statements, which I have no reason to think he wouldn't be, might have enough bodies later this week to, you know, host Bama on Saturday. So we'll see.
We shall see. So did you watch the game against Kentucky?
I did. Have not done a rewatch on it yet, but yeah, watched all of it in its entirety. And
it was a bizarre game, really.
Yeah, that was a weird game flow. Just utterly, and what was it, like 52-8 plus 44, and then
yeah,
you know, then minus 17 for Kentucky. Just a weird, like, Missouri was competent for 13 minutes of that game, and then just utterly hapless for the other 27. Just hard to read much out of that. Kentucky's a team that hasn't looked like they've found a stride yet either. I think that's obvious when you look at, you know, that they've taken, you know, a road loss to Notre Dame. Then they had, you know, they beat up on North Carolina, but North Carolina's not really been as good. I think North Carolina was sort of overstated. They haven't been as good defensively as I think a lot of people might have expected from a Tar Heels team. But, you know, North Carolina has lost, you know, games to pretty much anybody ranked inside, you know, the top 25 KenPom. So Kentucky, a team that right now has, I think its schedule is, overall schedule is 323rd in SOS. So long way of saying Kentucky is still a team figuring it out, but enough raw talent to do what it needed to do, even if there were some periods where it looked kind of rickety or stilted against a team like Missouri.
The realistically, if you strip out the rebounding advantage, you know, the offensive rebounding, I really thought that Kentucky's ability to generate second shots and get to the free throw line was really all that mattered in that game.
Yeah.
And they were just much, much better. And those two categories and everything else was enough of a wash that it, you know, just didn't matter.
The effective field goal percentage wasn't great, but when your free throw rate's like what, like 0.4 or something absurd, and you're just killing a team on the glass, you're generating so many additional possessions and so many high value attempts that, you know, even if you're clanking a bunch of jumpers, you're going to be able to pull through. And Missouri just, you know, I think we were talking about it, a normal shooting team, like not an exceptional shooting team, but, you know, with 10 minutes to go,
utter crap,
right? Like with 10 minutes to go, there's probably a ton of game pressure on UK at that point. I mean, they were only up 10, but Missouri was just shooting so poorly that it, you know, that had kind of gifted them the margin. But if you're shooting just a little bit better, you know, that's a young Kentucky team. You know, it's still a team that is still, you know, an average to adequate 3-point shooting team.
I feel like there was one play where I think it was DeGray who hit or took a three, and they were down maybe 11.
It kicked a run out off.
So it went from, like, you know, potentially, you know, cutting the lead down to 7 or 8 points to now all of a sudden it's back up to like 13.
And I think it was like a 3-point play. So it was like it was like a 6 or 7 point swing on two possessions. And then Missouri just couldn't find its way back the rest of the way. And that's kind of how it's been. But I felt like over the first 10 minutes of the second half, you know, it wasn't that they were executing all that well at times offensively, but this team had made it enough of a slog to where Kentucky just couldn't open a margin back up. And it's sort of a backhanded insult to say, like, Missouri did enough to gum it up for 10 minutes. Like, some teams go on big runs out of the locker room and really make it a game, and they give themselves plenty of time to take advantage. Missouri just made that a slow motion sort of comeback to get it down to 10. And, you know, again, because they just don't have much, you know, pop offensively, you know, a 6-point scoring jag is enough to really just put them down. So it was weird game flow where, like, you couldn't totally say Missouri was out of it, but then Kentucky hit them with that last avalanche and it was done. But the overall outcome, not much different than I think what you would have expected to see going into Rupp, and, you know, with an acting head coach and just kind of the offensive deficiencies that Missouri's got.
Yeah, Missouri hasn't had a lot of success playing in Rupp Arena. I think year one, when Frank was the coach, and they really didn't play well, and they should have beaten that Kentucky team. But they didn't. They lost.
Yeah.
But it was a close game. I want to say it maybe went to overtime.
It was 90-83, and that was after they'd lost New Orleans for the year. New Orleans had gone down with his knee injury.
Yeah, that's right.
And about 8 games prior. And
then, what was it, last year or year before, where they kind of played him tough, but still not close enough? But every other game feels like it's been a blowout.
Yeah, and they usually come early in the non-conference slate, too. So it's not like you get... Usually when they've had success, it's been when they've gotten Kentucky kind of later in the slate and at home. But again, I don't think that was a game, regardless of how bad this team was playing now. I think in the preseason, you wouldn't have said that trip to Lexington and Rupp was going to be a barometer for this team. I thought having Mississippi State come in, at least in the preseason, was going to be a really, really nice sort of, you know, gauge of where this team was. And, you know, Mississippi State's, as usual, played its week non-con schedule, so it's kind of an open question as to how good they are. But I really thought, you know, if, you know, that was going to be a good measuring stick game for them, was to get, you know, and they've played Mississippi State well at home over the last couple of years too. So I thought that might have been a game where if you were in a little bit of a lull, maybe it would get you out of it. But again, that assumed that this team would not be anywhere as close to bad as it's been. So now it's got to get pushed off, and they get Alabama at coming in to Columbia. So we'll see how that one looks at the end of the week.
Yeah, the Bulldogs, as usual, prior to beating Arkansas at home, had just one top 100 win in KenPom, and they beat Richmond in overtime, who is 93rd in overtime on a neutral floor.
But yeah, took a loss by 14 to Louisville, who's 53rd, lost by 5 to Minnesota, who's 68th, and a 3-point loss to Colorado State, who is 35th.
Who's coaching Colorado State these days, Matt?
One Mr. Nico Medved.
Nico Medved, he's done a good job there.
Done a good job at Furman, done a good job in 1 year at Drake, good job out there. Name a lot of people are probably going to, if they don't already know it, they're going to know it over the next 2 months. A lot of fan bases are going to want to know more about Nico. They picked off Mississippi State, like, on a neutral court event in Dallas that nobody went to. I watched part of that game. It was just very sad that there was nobody. I'm sure the people of the Dallas Metroplex were not gigged up to see the Bulldogs and the Rams in early December.
Like you're going to go into Lucas City in a boring college game. like they're used to watching Luka, man. They got more fun basketball to watch.
They've got more fun things to do than college basketball in Dallas. So, yeah.
Can't imagine there's a whole lot of, you know, state grads hanging out in the Metroplex, you know, looking in. And where is Colorado State? Are they in Fort Collins?
Yep, they're in Fort Collins. A very, very pretty town.
And a nice beer scene there.
Indeed. So Alabama's coming to town, and I'm interested in that game only because Alabama does not look like the death machine that I think a lot of people assumed they would be. I know you and I were skeptical of that roster. Not that they were going to be bad, but that there were some.
We thought they were going to be good. But
not
how
they were
good.
Close to what they were last year.
Yeah. I just don't think you lose a guy like, you know, like Herbert Jones on defense and a guy like John Petty on offense and just shrug that off. As much as, you know, you and I both really like Jaden Shackelford, I just don't think, you know, Javon Quinterly defends at the same level. You know,
even a guy like Josh Primo, like,
yeah, like
was a lottery pick and like
that's
a really,
crazy.
Really good. But he's doing a really, really great job with the Spurs G League affiliate. I watched him during the winter showcase. He's doing a really, really good job there. They just don't have room for him on that roster, but put a little more weight and experience on him. He's going to be a good player. But shot 38% last year. So you took, you know, those two shooters off the roster, a Swiss Army Knife defender, and even like a big like Alex Reese is gone. You know, not, you know, just a really, really solid, literally a solid big, you know, not anywhere close to like the athletic ceiling of like Charles Bediako, but just fit that lineup really well.
Well, yeah, a guy who's a lot more likely to space the floor. And, you know, like I think that was like Reese's component that he brought. I mean, he didn't shoot an elite percentage, but he shot it well enough
to pull a big out of that.
Yeah, to actually warrant you defending him. And then, you know, Jordan Bruner, I think, is a guy who, you know, had a really nice season. If he'd have been a little more healthy, I think he probably would have had a little bit more of an impact. But
yeah, they've got, I'm looking over to kind of their minutes distribution right now. And, you know, they've got J.D. Davison, who my man's got a 29.1 assist rate against a 31.7 turnover rate. He is bouncy as hell, but there's some turnover issues. He's shooting 28% from deep. That's your backup point guard, essentially behind Quinterly. Quinterly's shooting has fallen off. He's shooting 27%. So your lead guards, one's turnover prone and neither of them are really spacing the floor the way that you would want them to. Shackelford's still stroking the three balls at a 39% clip and doing a good job there. Defensively, you and I think there are times when he can be good defensively, but there are times when, you know, he seems to just kind of muddle through. They need him to be much, much more locked in and engaged.
Yeah, he's not a committed defender. Like he's definitely not like Petty and Jones had bought into being defensive stalwarts last year. I still think Keon
Ellis
was
a better defender than anyone ever gave him credit for.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But you look at Noah Gurley, a guy who was like this big time transfer out of Furman, shooting 24%, you know, doing well around the rim. But, you know, again, if the idea was that you're going to have a four man who can kind of be that spacer, that hasn't really happened. Juwan Gary's at 28%. They're just not shooting the ball well enough to keep those double gaps open for them. And instead of having, you know, a, you know, Alex Reese out on the perimeter, Charles Bediako is in the paint area. So you just have an extra defender in there. There's more rim protection. They just aren't quite the same offensively as they were a year ago. They're only 201st nationally in three-point shooting. So that kind of makes the three and layup model hard. But defensively, they aren't any. I mean, they're 46th in adjusted efficiency, but they were 30 a year ago. They're 216th in two-point defense, which I think is a better barometer of how good you are defensively than your three-point shooting percentage. There's a little bit more variability there. You know, they're not creating the turnovers that they kind of need at times to really get that transition game going. They're not the same as they were a year ago. They're still good. They're still going to be an NCAA tournament team. Still think they could be a top four team in this conference, but just not the same group. And that's fair. You know, I think you and I talked about it, how they put teams away last year probably wasn't sustainable this year. They were going to have to get a little bit more consistent out of their offense And that just hasn't happened quite yet. And the defense has regressed a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, and they're still really good. So, like, yeah. I don't want, like, this isn't us saying that, you know, Alabama is trash. They're still, like, one of the three or four best teams in the league. You know, the SEC has some decent teams. I think Auburn's a little better than people thought they were going to be. I was a little skeptical of Auburn's guard play, but Wendell Green.
You know my feelings on Wendell. You know my feelings.
And I still don't love Katie Johnson, but you know, he does what he does. Like he's
a human bowling ball on the perimeter and does stuff.
And they have elite rim protection. Walker Kessler, Jabari Smith's awesome.
Alan Flanagan's back.
I really thought that they were going to struggle a little bit with, you know, Flanagan not kind of being a reliable wing scorer. And you know, early on, they haven't missed him a whole lot. So that's good for them.
Yeah. But with Bama coming in, like the one thing, again, with Missouri, this is going to be a theme for us, I think, as we go through every preview, is what's a deficiency and how pronounced is it for their opponent? Like, don't get me wrong. If Bama goes on a scoring jag where they're canning everything, it's over. Like, Missouri just, the math will not work in Missouri's favor. More so than usual. So there's not an insignificant amount of, like, blowout factor there. If, like, Bama comes in and they're canning them, their volume is just going to overwhelm Missouri. It won't matter what Missouri does offensively, or even if Missouri sort of average offensively. When Bama was drilling three balls in spades a year ago, they were overwhelming average offenses. But at the same point in time, Bama's also prone to stretches where they clank everything. And that is a feast or famine-based offense, where if they're not scoring off paint, where everything they want to do is create double gaps. They want the shooting to open up and put you in rotation, create double gaps, and then drive it. If they're not shooting it well, those gaps kind of shrink up on them, and Bediako's in there. The spacing can get a little wonky. Bediako, I wouldn't say he's a traditional kind of bruising big. He's 7 foot, but he's kind of lean and more bouncy and more of a, not finesse, but he's not, you know, Oscar Tshiebwe or Tolu Smith or any of those guys. So if you've got an undersized big, you can kind of hang with him a little bit. So that's really Missouri's key here, is hope that Bama's just ice cold, the gaps shrink up, and you can kind of clog things and congest it enough that they're not able to really get the rhythm fired up the way they want it. Bama's pace comes off offense. That's kind of a little bit different than normal. Normally we say pace comes off how you guard. That's very much not the case with Bama. They'll have longer defensive possessions, but if you make them work offensively in the half court, you might give yourself a faint chance of making it into something where you can tussle it away. But
what's the recipe that Missouri used last year to beat them, really? And
yeah,
you know, they frustrated them on offense, and they were able to sort of, you know,
they beat them in transition.
Yeah, they're able, you know, flip the field as a metaphor a little bit, you know, and really sort of, you know, take it to Alabama, something that they weren't really used to. They were used to kind of setting the tone, you know, with tempo through their defense, you know, and really falling back and kind of playing that pack line and making it difficult. Missouri was just beating them down the floor.
Half court wise, Missouri also, I think, did a really nice job of kind of using Jeremiah Tillman as a snow plow in those high pick and rolls, just to really, really clear out a gap. His rolls were almost delayed, so he could just basically block downfield for Pinson or Smith. And if somebody did get to him, you could dump or lob to him. They don't have that option this year, I think. So it'll be interesting what Missouri does offensively here. This feels like a game where Amari Davis has not played well against good teams this year. This feels like a game where Bama's, you know, pack line is going to want to give him those mid-range looks. This would be a really good game for Amari to kind of get rolling a little bit and sort of eat in the mid-range from about 12 to 17 feet. But offensively, I don't know what Missouri's really got. They see teams that basically pack line them and load up. Like, if you look at defenses, they pretty much load up to the side and load up in gaps and to the side where the ball screens are going to be taking place. So feels like they're going to need Amari and maybe some transition opportunities to give themselves a chance in this one. But, I mean, again, I don't want to oversell the possibility there, but that's the model, I think. I don't know if you agree or if you've got a different sort of
projection. It's a projected 12-point loss on Ken Pomeroy, so I don't really think that there's a whole lot of reason to think that they'll be able to win. I do think that they sort of have enough, and with the way Alabama plays, that, you know, it could be interesting. But I just, you know, when it comes to shot making ability down the stretch, I just think Alabama, you know, especially how good they are at 2-point percentage. I think they're shooting almost 60% from 2-point range.
At this point, it's Missouri doesn't have guys. Missouri doesn't have a guy you can give the ball to and say, go make offense either. No. There's not someone who can, you know, we thought for a little bit that Amari Davis might be that, but then, you know, you've seen what he's done against good defenses and it's just been tough sledding for him. So even if Missouri's able to kind of do what they did against almost against Kentucky and keep it at that 8-10 margin for 10 minutes, is there a player or a, you know, suite of plays they can call to really put that game pressure on Bama? And until we see that, I'm skeptical that it exists. So
I agree with that. We'll have an opportunity to kind of talk, you know, provided they're able to play the game, which, like I said earlier, it does appear that they're going to be able to play. And we also don't know who is going to be able to play. Like, even if they, they have, you know, eight guys clear protocols, like, what eight guys? Like, is, you know, are Caleb Brown and Jordan Wilmore two of those eight? Like, if that's the case, then I feel a lot worse than, you know, if you're running out like your top eight. But yeah, I mean, everything is sort of up in the air, and I guess we'll see on Saturday. Matt, did you peruse the article that I posted on after the new year, talking about what we would like to see from Missouri basketball in 2020?
I did. Very, very, very level-headed. As always, your pieces on, you know, where you want to see the program go in a calendar year are always sort of, I think, broad enough but reasonable enough that, you know, you can look back a year later and say, yeah, this did or did not happen. But I agree pretty much with the overall thesis, I think, which is they just need to find a new direction. And I, you know, I would say my general view is I think that's a staged process. Like, I think you can take it in phases. I think in the near term, can they overhaul the offense enough and the rotation along with it, you know, to make themselves competitive and, you know, through SEC play and, you know, parcel out minutes in a way that ensure that they're competitive, but also developing freshmen at the same time. I think that's been my biggest complaint over the last couple of weeks is there are two freshmen in the starting lineup, but it's more of a cosmetic change. When you really dig into the numbers and you dig in to the tape and sort of everything else like that, they've made some changes.
You don't have to dig very far into the numbers to see that, like, Anton Brookshire has been starting the games, but not playing very long.
Right. And I don't think he's playing in lineups that give him much of a chance to get traction.
Right.
So it's like, what are we really doing here? What are we building toward? So I think there's got to be that full scale commitment to, we are going to, you know, invest real time, real game time in, you know, these future pieces. We are going to try and, you know, really as much as possible. You can't rip out an offense and install a new one. There's just not enough time for that. But we are going to do what we can to reorient the offense in a way towards what we actually do well, towards what we, you know, I know people will laugh and scoff that they don't do anything well, but what they're doing still right now. Like we talked about it after the Utah game, there were some things that they did in the Utah game that I think could have been building blocks for a schematic shift that would not have required, you know, a ton of, you know, rejiggering of the offense. But then we haven't seen any of them since. So, you know, you look at the piece that Matt Watkins posted today, a lot of that looks familiar offensively for what we've seen from them. So that's the near term. And then I think, as you mentioned, have a momentum changing spring. That can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. I think everyone, you know, would assume that means another round of roster overhaul and, you know, looking at who are the guys putting that roster together. And then I think just more globally, we talked about it a little last week, Zoe sitting down and really deciding what he wants the identity of this program to be. You know, the scheme can come as a result of that. You know, the recruiting model, all that stuff. I think he's got to really sit down and commit and really look at what he's done the last 4 or 5 years and say what, because it feels like, you know, we've talked about, there's not really anything that I can succinctly say what Missouri basketball is. I think that's got to change. And if it doesn't, then I don't know, even if he gets another year, what you're really building towards at that point. I think there's just got to be, you know, everything's got to sort of, you know, you've got to kind of put the fires out as they come, or check off the, or eat the elephant one bite at a time here. They've got to find out something right now in the next couple months to keep this, you know, their jobs. Then they've got to go into spring, you know, fashioning a roster that can, you know, be competitive next year. And they've got to think about at the same time what the overarching vision is moving forward, because the one they're using right now is clearly not working. And so I think that's really where my head's at, is they've got to take it in stages, but there has to be some fundamental changes at the end of it.
And I think
as we go through the year.
Yeah, that's kind of, you know, like what I was essentially trying to say with find a new direction. You know, I'm, as we've been recording this, you know, podcast for, you know, a while, and we've spent a good amount of time talking about Consul Martin and sort of my respect for Consul Martin. And I think he has adapted sort of his approach in a lot of ways. But at the same time, like, I almost feel like he's at this point probably over adapted. And he's gone into areas where he isn't completely comfortable. He doesn't have anyone on staff who seems to be comfortable. And so, like, you get this product that is really, I mean, poor, for lack of, you know, better phrase there. And, you know, when you look back, I mean, whatever you want to say about, you know, aesthetic basketball and, you know, like, oh, everybody wants to show up, you know, the style of play is what's keeping people away. And you hear people say stuff like that. And it's like, I don't believe that at all, because, like, you know, Virginia fans pack the house to watch Tony Bennett teams walk the ball before, you know, and play a, you know, blocker mover offense that looks like it's, you know, straight out of the, you know, 1950s. Like, it's an old school approach. It works. It's very effective. And, obviously, like, his talent level has dipped in the last couple of years. And that's, I think, impacted, you know, Virginia's ability to sort of make up those margins in so few possessions. But I'm a big believer that there are a million different ways that you can play and be successful playing, but you really have to, especially as a college coach, because you are the CEO, you're the guy who controls the roster. You add pieces, you recruit them, and you're not a high school coach. You're not going through the kids in the talent pool and being like, well, I guess you're kind of a point guard. And, you know, like at Webster, like, we would have teams that were small and quick 1 year, and then 2 years later, you have, you know, two big slow kids who are good around the block. And it's like, okay, so we have to adapt. And you don't really have to do that as a college coach. You can pick the system that you want and then go get the players that fit the system. Or you can kind of do what I think you and I kind of agree that Kermit Davis does. He just goes out and tries to get the best players he can and then finds a way to make it work. And when you're a middling, like middle class program, like Missouri is and Ole Miss is, like it becomes more difficult. So I think stylistically, if Martin just wanted to just be defense and rebounding guy, like if you just want to commit to that and be a slog on offense, if you're top 30 in KenPom, like I don't think anybody's really complaining. I'm sure that they could say, okay, yeah, we want to see you win more, but you're winning. Like, and I think like that's for me what it boils down to is Martin has changed and adapted himself to the point where he's no longer recognizable for the guy that gained accolades as a leader at Missouri State and rebuilding Tennessee and Cal's a different kind of job, but the things that worked early on at Missouri aren't, like, none of that is working. And I think like a lot of that has just been Martin compromising himself into a place where, like, he's doing things for the sake of doing them and not necessarily like defining his program.
Like a couple weeks ago, there's a piece on Purdue and how, their offense sort of functions. And, Matt Painter's got 120 something plays in his book. And he sort of says every year we adapt to the personnel we have. And you might think, well, that sounds a lot like what Konzo's doing, but I can tell you what a Purdue wing looks like. I can tell you what a Purdue 4 looks like. I can tell you what a Purdue 5 looks like. If the EYBL is in Indianapolis, I can go to a court, see where Matt Painter is sitting, and I can tell you and feel pretty confident without looking at like a kid's recruiting profile who he's watching on the floor. And yeah, he changes and he adapts his system every year to his personnel, but that's because Purdue has a pretty clear checklist of what it wants in its players. And, rosters will change every year because guys will graduate, some will transfer, some guys will go pro. But Matt has recruited guys that have skill sets that he wants. And then he'll just pick the different pieces of that playbook to fit with them. I'm not sure that happens at Missouri. I think Konzo we saw what he wanted, I think, here, which is to be a switch everything team. We've talked about a switch everything defense. He wanted basically blurred lines between 2 and 4 on the position chart. And, wanted to, I think, keep, wanted multiple ball handlers, wanted to kind of keep the offense in place that he had a year ago, except the offense he had a year ago had defined ball handlers. It had a defined 5. And those two things were absolutely essential because if you're going to have, wings and combo guards and a stretch 4 that can do different things, the thing that had to power all that was the threat of a middle ball screen. And Missouri doesn't have that. And so it feels like I'm looking at a roster that's got all the things that would exist, but not the two most important things. And to me, that's sort of the issue here is this was an intentional process. Like, they could have, when they had guys transfer out, maybe they could have gone back to Mark Smith and said, hey, we want you to stick around and do a fifth year here. We need a floor spacer and a really good on-ball defender. Then maybe you would have had a jump shooter that could have opened up some more gaps for your point guards who weren't really point guards. Maybe you could have gone into the portal and really hunted for a true, pass first point guard that could really create out of ball screens, but they didn't go get that. And so I think that's always been my issue, is much less scheme, because I think scheme can change and coaches can adapt scheme, however, but I look at this roster and no matter what scheme you're playing, it's missing some components. And, the thing you need now more in college basketball than anything is, we talk about it's a guard-driven game. You need a true point guard and if anything, the skill you need most in basketball now is shooting, and Missouri doesn't have it. And as I said earlier, it doesn't have a five that's really a good roller threat to play out of those middle ball screens. So like they're missing two or three of the most fundamental components they would need, and that was after a considered plan. So we've talked about it a lot. I'm going to stop talking about it now. But that's really, I think they've got to sit down and they've got to really decide what those pieces are, what they're looking for there. And then, like you're saying, any approach they take after that, that's fine. But I think they've got to have a clear sense of, you know, the type of player they want, the type of assets they want, and then build off of that. So we'll see. But, you know, at this point, you know, I'll believe it when I see it. And you know, I'll be frank. I've moved on to the point where I've started watching other coaches and other systems.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're making jokes about Medved. I think he's high up on both of our lists. Should the decision be made to move on from Martin, I think like that, you know, there are a few clear guys that you are going to have to check in with, and he's one of them. I don't think you're unrealistic in saying like we are probably preparing for some kind of coaching change, you know, but it doesn't necessarily stop Martin and his staff from like figuring something else out. And like, that's the thing that to me, that which has been sort of the most frustrating about this, is I was willing to kind of give this whole roster changeover a shot, but they went like long on this, you know, idea that, you know, and he talked about it as like his videos, the idea that like you're recruiting like the mid-major plus guy. You know, and while that's a great clip, you know, talking it's about great, like the kind of attitude that you want within your program, like at some point, like that's not enough. And
it's, because everybody works hard.
Right. And like, that's the thing, like when you get to the high major level, like everybody's working like really hard. And the
most programs are.
Yeah. Not everybody.
Like there's some. Yeah.
Like, and realistically, like, you know, when, you know, like a guy is immensely talented, but doesn't necessarily work hard. I think like there are plenty of guys who've sort of cycled through not just Missouri over the years, but other programs. I think, like you've went and watched, like, what was the Antavion Collum? What was his name? It was a guy who just had everything you could want in a basketball player, the way he moved, the size, the skill. But there was no desire to play the game. You could tell because he just wasn't very good. Like, he didn't play hard. He, like, and all these sort of elements that come through with hard work, like, they weren't there. But at the same time, like, you can work and work and work and work and work. But if your talent level is medium, then you have a cap on how good you can be. And I think Missouri has a lot of guys in the roster right now that are just sort of built into that same mold, you know, whereas, you know, Martin was a really pretty talented guy. And like, there's a reason he's being recruited to the Big Ten, you know, and not like University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, like he was being offered by Big Ten schools because he was a Big Ten level player. And he also, you know, worked his tail off to become a middling NBA player, despite having, you know, like
some, one knee.
Yeah, some pretty, you know, terrible issues with his knees. So like, and I almost wonder like if that's like part of the blind spot is, he thinks, oh, well, like, I worked as hard as this kid is working. That means that this kid can get to where I was. And it's like, well, you're selling yourself short here, dude. Like, you are really talented. And I just think that there's just not enough talent. Like, if Kobe Brown is your fourth option, and Kobe Brown's been a good player, but if he's your first option, like, that's a problem.
Like, I'll phrase it this way, or I'll give this example. Over the weekend, I watched Seton Hall Villanova. Villanova Seton Hall's down to 8 dudes through COVID protocols. They're starting Trey Jackson. Trey Jackson scores 2 points in the game. But what Trey does for his 20 or 25 or 30 minutes that he's out there is guards his ass off. Guards his absolute ass off. Doesn't always get a rebound, but he's fighting for position. He's occupying someone else so his buddy or his teammate can get a rebound. Running the floor hard. Getting on the floor. All the things that you would want a Konzo Martin player to do. That, you know, Kevin Willard is getting out of him. You know, he's not at Missouri. You know, but, you know, early on, though, if you had said that that's going to be Trey Jackson and you had watched him his first year at Missouri, you'd have said there's no way that's going to happen. Because there are times, you know, when there'd be mistakes and he'd be pulled. There'd be, you know, maybe some issues on the floor. He'd be pulled. Whereas Kobe Brown might make a similar mistake and not be pulled. And, you know, again, we didn't see practice. We didn't know what was going on behind the scenes. But you would wonder, what's giving one guy some rope and the other guy not getting some rope? You know, there was a piece that was written in mid-December where Torrence Watson was saying, you know, at Missouri, I always felt like there was a lot of pressure because I had to come off the bench, get it right. I had to make something happen. I had to get something going so I could keep playing. And, you know, I don't think it's out of line to say that affected, you know, his mentality on offense. You know, he would say, you know, my job on offense was to come down and hold a corner. I didn't feel necessarily comfortable or confident playing off the dribble sometimes. But, you know, you'll watch Javon Pickett and you'll see, you know, what Pickett's doing. And there's that confidence there because Martin's given it to him. And so you wonder at times whether, and I don't think, you know, Martin's, you know, sitting there saying, I want to, you know, make this guy feel like crap or make this guy feel special. But whether subconsciously what you're talking about plays out, whether his preferences sort of betray themselves at times. And, you know, how guys are used and opportunities they receive. And that trickles down, you know. Basketball players, you know, need confidence. You know, they need to feel like there's trust there. And if that's not there, those guys will go elsewhere. But Torrence is playing really well at Elon. Trey Jackson's playing really well, you know, in his role as kind of a sixth guy for Seton Hall. You know, Mark Smith went for 25 at Oklahoma over the weekend. You know, we joke about Xavier Pinson, but he's, you know, fit in to a degree at LSU.
LSU's been way better than I thought they were going to be, and a lot of that is because they've been good defensively. Now, admittedly, I have not watched them more than a few minutes here and there, and even when I did, like, you know, X wasn't really playing a whole lot. You know, so I don't know if he's finally found whatever commitment he needed defensively, but for whatever reason, he wasn't defending here.
Right. But I mean, again, that's the thing you talk about is these guys have found something that they were lacking, you know, while they were here. And, you know, if you believe that Martin's a mentality coach, and if you believe that he's going to get guys to buy in, do what they need to do, that raises some questions to me as to what happens here and, you know, as to the evaluation. So I'm not saying, again, Zoe's out here playing mind games or trying to make guys feel like crap, but there's a managing people and sort of personalities thing that I've always wondered about and how that plays out. So we'll see moving forward, but it's been hard in that sort of sense to see kind of what's transpired as guys have moved on and what they're doing in new roles and in new places.
Well, we're up against it here. And we've already kind of hit all of the topics I at least wanted to talk about. You know, what we all want to see from Missouri basketball in 2022 is just be better. Like, more better, Matt.
More good.
Yeah, like, and I don't think it would take complete like 180 turnaround kind of thing for me to be on board with bringing Konzo Martin back. But the biggest thing for me out of that whole theme was they have to find a new direction, something else than what they've been doing the last few years, because it has not been working.
Yeah, and I think the last point I'll make is if you read, you know, stuff from the people who are around the programmer every day more so than we are, you know, the constant refrain is, you know, seems to be that there's not an aching desire to make a change right now. Setting aside the $6 million cost of said change, you know, Desiree Reed Francois knows Zoe from her time at Tennessee. I think, you know, it's been reported that she admires Zoe, that they're on good terms. I just don't think that there's a real appetite, you know, even aside from the finances, to go make a change here. But, you know, to your point, finding a new direction has to happen. It has to. And, you know, if Zoe's going to talk, you know, if Zoe's talking about, you know, we're getting there, we're on the right track, at some point, that's got to manifest itself on the floor. And if it doesn't, and, you know, then I think you put your boss in a position where it's like, what else can you do? You know, I really think that's where we are here. Zoe's got to show over the next 6 to 8 weeks that this, you know, progress that's happening behind closed doors is going to show up when the lights go on, or he's going to make enough changes to course correct. If neither of those things happen, I don't know if it'll really matter if there's, you know, administrative appetite or, you know, financial, you know, qualms about making a move. It may just be that that's finding a new direction's got to be what's got to be the course that happens and that they follow. So we'll see.
Yeah, the new direction has to happen at some level, and I believe it is either Council Martin needs to find a new direction, the administration needs to find a new coach to find the right direction. But even through, like, and this will kind of be the last thing I'll say, even if, like, whichever decision is made there, if it's keep the coach, move on, the commitment has to come down. And I think this will kind of piggyback into the piece that you're going to run, that Missouri wants to be more competitive in basketball financially. And that has to come from the administration. Like, that has to expand over, you know, what we've seen for the last 2+ decades. You know, for Missouri fans, you and I included in that, what we would like to see is a competitive basketball program. I'm not asking for national championships. I want competitiveness. And I think that there are coaches out there that are not Consul Martin that can bring the program with a menial investment up to that level that we all want it to be at. If they're consistent enough, maybe you invest more and more and more and see where it goes. But, you know, and that's me not even saying that, you know, Consul Martin can't be that guy. He's just got to have, like, a spring of soul searching and make some really kind of deep seated changes to his approach and the way sort of he views success at this level. We good?
An uplifting pot as usual.
But yeah, everybody check out Matt's piece. It'll be publishing later this week about the finances, as Matt is, you know, one to be. It can be a little long-winded in places, but the information there is second to none, and I'm really excited to get to publish this piece. I think we actually teased it over the summer, so but now it is. What we were kind of joking before we went on air, I actually think it's better that we didn't publish this during the summer, because I think it's a lot more appropriate right now, because it gives us sort of a foundation of kind of where we were, like, you know, 5 years ago, like when I was talking about what kind of job the Missouri job was, and this is sort of like a reintroduction to that. So make sure everybody to subscribe to this podcast if you're not already. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, those all go to Levi. Leave me out of it, please. You can follow Matt on Twitter if you want. Matt J. Harris 85. I am at Sam T. Snelling. I'm really not tweeting much these days, Matt. Staying off the tweets.
As am I. Yeah. It's Mario related.
Now, any chance to fire off a good Mario tweet. But you and I will be back. One of these days, we're going to get the at, I can't remember, is it Data Mizzou?
I think so.
Yeah, we're going to get the other Matt. It's going to be two Matts and a Sam. And we'll have him on the podcast. You'll have a new voice to hear, you know, bad things about Missouri basketball from. So until then, thanks everybody for tuning in. Have a great weekend, and hopefully Missouri can make things interesting against Alabama. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks for tuning in.